Bitcoiners, welcome back to another episode of FedWatch. I'm here with Ansel and regular guest Dylan LeClaire. Dylan is our head of market intelligence and research over at Bitcoin Magazine. He heads up the Deep Dive newsletter, and every single month we sit down with him to go over his Deep Dive monthly review. Today is the first week of November, we're going to be reviewing everything that's happening in the grand scheme of things when it comes to Bitcoin. We also are going to hit on some really pertinent Fed news around tightening and QE. Got a really good show lined up for y'all. Dylan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks again for having me, guys. I'm excited to dig in here and talk some Bitcoin and central banks.
So yeah, always excited to talk to you about what's happening in macro. But we have some pretty big personal news for you as well. I know that beyond just working at Bitcoin Magazine, you've expanded your role over at BTC Inc.
Yeah, so just announced about 30 minutes ago on Twitter, joining the UTXO team. So they're a fund that kind of attempts to generate alpha on top of Bitcoin by navigating the kind of the boom and bust cycles. So this traditionally was kind of the halving cycle, but Bitcoin just, you know, trades cyclically, trades reflexively. So, I'm joining the team as a senior market analyst to, attempt to bring some intelligence and, analysis to what they're doing over there.
Yeah, no, I'm super excited for you with that. You and Sam have been doing really incredible work at Bitcoin Magazine, and I think there's just a lot of symmetries with our fund. And for everyone out there who's listening, Bitcoin Magazine is part of the BTC Inc. family. So that's the Bitcoin conference, that's UTXO, that's Earn Carrot, and obviously Bitcoin Magazine. So we are, in my opinion, the ultimate Bitcoin company, and really lucky to have Dylan on the team and Ansel as part of that family. So again, congrats, Dylan, and let's get into this week's agenda. Ansel, some big news from the Fed.
Yeah. Before I jump into the Fed, I just want to plug the Kansas City event. It's a Bitcoin Day event in Kansas City this weekend. So if you guys are anywhere near Kansas City and want to venture out and meet some people, hear some people talk about Bitcoin in person, check out Bitcoin Day Omaha. Okay, Bitcoinday.io. All right, let's jump into the Fed talk. Now, they're meeting today and tomorrow, and we all expect a taper decision. We don't know if, well, it's almost guaranteed that they will be tapering, or starting to taper, but we don't know if it's November or December, if it's going to be $15 billion a month, less each month, or maybe 20 or 10. We're not sure on the exact number. But some of the interesting things that I've pulled up over the last week is there is a lot of disagreement among central banks. So the Fed is talking about taper. The ECB is talking about holding steady. The BOJ is also holding steady. They pretty much have no taper anywhere in the foreseeable future. And the PBOC is increasing their stimulus. You know, they're having all the trouble with Evergrande and the contagion in the real estate market there. So they are going the opposite way as the Fed. Now, when you look at the smaller emerging markets, or even some of the other smaller G7 countries like Canada and the UK, they are going to be curtailing their QE and possibly even raising rates. So Canada has already curtailed or already ended their QE, and the UK is talking about pulling back on their QE or tapering as well. So I don't know, there's disagreement among the central banks. And before I get into some of the warning signs, do you guys have any comments on the taper or what we see kind of disagreement among the central banks?
I think it's pretty interesting that, taper has now turned into just reducing the scale of QE, where they're still talking about expanding the balance sheet, reducing the acceleration of the balance sheet expansion. And I think in terms of the Fed, I think they're in a tough spot. Well, really every central bank, because of the supply chain issues, because of, now it's not just asset inflation, but the consumers are starting to feel this with the stuff that the CPI measures, the PCE, whether it's food, energy, just going to the grocery store is a lot more expensive. A lot of this stuff isn't even measured with shrinkflation. They're in a tough spot where the asset inflation and all the debt dynamics that have you, Ansel, as a deflationist, this coming up against this massive inflationary event. And so they're, you know, they're kind of stuck in a hard spot here. I know I wouldn't want to be a central banker because, you know, it's really kind of a lose-lose situation.
Yeah, I think Powell really wishes he had some support from the Congress, you know, on the fiscal side, but it seems like there is more gridlock than ever. They barely were able to push the debt ceiling back once again. Is it even a ceiling if you just keep pushing it back? What do you think about Congress, and is he going to get any help on that side?
Yeah, I think it's just a game of chicken where, regardless of what Congress does or Powell or any kind of central bank governor, especially in the U.S., just with the U.S. being the world reserve currency, the dollar really can't spike for a sustained period of time without just destroying the global economy. So if it comes with this taper or, it's kicked down the road a little bit, it's, you know, some sort of deleveraging, some sort of liquidity event is inevitable at some point, just with the dollar against other fiats, because essentially it's kind of like almost a race to the bottom, the incentives of fiat currency and how the global economic system is shaped. And so I think the U.S., they're going to have to continue to kind of debase the dollar relative to these other currencies, because if not, there's going to be kind of this global dollar squeeze where every asset sells off, the global economy tanks. It's not even up for decision or debate. It's just a matter of, you know, how hard can they jawbone and walk the line until that event happens.
Yeah, I hear you. I have some more charts here to maybe talk about warning signs. So I'm going to jump in. All right. So over here, the Treasury yield curve today, you can see this, the 20-year and the 30-year is inverted. Also, the 1 month and the 3 month are inverted. So there's two inversions in the curve right now. And this curve seems pretty steep, right? But that's because it only goes up to 2.25%. instead of like a realistic 5 or 10%. If it was, if the y-axis was extended where a normal rate would be, this would be very, very flat. But I just wanted to point out that there is an inversion at the long end of the curve. Also, the 5-year rate, there is a pretty big inversion here between the 5-year break even and the 10-year break even. And I actually charted it out to show the difference. And it is the biggest inversion in the history of these break even tips. So that's pretty significant, if you ask me. That's a pretty big inversion between the 5-year and the 10-year. Any comment on that, guys?
Yeah, well, so I would love to hear both Dylan as well as Ansel kind of explain why these inversions are so important and like why that's a big deal. Just because I, for one, I don't even know, what I'm looking at.
Ansel, you want to give that one a go?
Yeah, well, the inversions kind of matter because, traditionally, okay, so the 2-year and the 10-year, a traditional interest rate curve is going to be upward sloping because the banks, they borrow short and they lend long. So they have to have some way to make money. So they borrow at a lower interest rate and they lend at a higher interest rate. During periods or right before almost every recession since World War II, you see an inversion of that rate. And that is where people are, more scared about near-term chaos. And so the yield curve inverts. People rush towards safety. I guess that kind of explains it a little bit. Dylan, do you have any more to add to that?
Yeah, I guess it's just the yield curve inverts because it's kind of foreshadowing a liquidity crunch or a credit contraction, which is what you kind of described. I'm not the foremost expert on the bond market, but I think it has been kind of a leading recession indicator ever since we've had a developed treasury market. So I think that's important to point out.
Excellent. Okay, I had a couple more things here on warning signs. The reverse repo. So remember, the reverse repo is up at $1.4 trillion every night. And if the Fed is going to be curtailing asset purchases, perhaps there will be less quantity or less reverse repo and more cash in the system anyway. Because, okay, so the way it works with quantitative easing, right, is that the Fed is taking securities off the market, and the reverse repo is just the opposite. Banks are giving dollars or lending dollars to get those securities back onto the market. So if they are going to be lessening QE, what is going to be the effect on the reverse repo? It might like be a wash anyway, even if it was some sort of fundamental, it might be a wash anyway. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I kind of think of the reverse repo as it's a way to keep the front end of the treasury curve nominally positive. Because they're doing so much asset purchases that they're taking all this collateral out of the financial system, and banks, the Fed can't print money. They can only print bank reserves. So the banks have a bunch of reserves and almost no collateral. So these front end, basically like the reverse repo says you can get 5 basis points on your reserves with the Fed. And so you see, basically, if you look at the short end of the treasury curve, what is it, 1 month, 3 month, just like the short term, the shortest term securities, those have been basically locked at 5 basis points. And one of them actually flashed nominally negative just briefly, I think earlier in the summer. And so I kind of view it as just a way, they're just kind of pinning that front end of the curve nominally positive, even though in real terms, it's obviously with CPI at 5 or 6% or whatever inflation, measure you want to use. They're far negative.
Excellent. And then I just had one more thing with coming up on this taper decision from Powell is that Predict-It still has him at 67% odds over Lael Brainard to stay chairman of the Fed. So he's still popular. I don't know if they're going to pin some sort of, if he does do this taper now and we have some sort of double dip recession, if they're going to try to pin it on him to get Lael Brainard in. I mean, these are all kind of total speculation and total, game planning out the future. But right now, Powell is sitting a pretty heavy favorite.
Where is that in terms of historically where Powell stacked up? Because my memory serves me, he was like a 90%, not even that long ago. So it does seem as though he's losing some sort of favorability. Am I incorrect with that?
Sorry, I'm just going back on Predict-It right now. The farthest back they have is 90 days, and he's been in the 70s all the way back since August. So he's roughly the same, maybe slightly lower.
Fair enough. Dylan, what do you think of like Powell being made into a scapegoat and people move and, I guess, politically, there's a move to bring in someone who's more of a like ECB style, more, I guess, like loose with monetary policy type of a chairman.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have too much insight onto who they would bring or what. I think it's just a credibility thing, honestly. I think regardless of who it is, they just, they need someone to go up there with a bold face and say everything's going to be okay and say, and act like they have it under control. And so if that's Powell, then it's Powell. And if Powell loses credibility because the markets tank or because the S&P is pumping and inflation's ripping and they won't raise rates, whatever it is, it's kind of both sides of the spectrum. I think they're going to want to bring in someone that has credibility. And if that's Powell, that's Powell. And I think a lot of the ethics concerns and stuff with Fed governors that happened over the last couple of months is really convenient. These guys are riding off into the sunset. And so I don't really have too much to offer there, but I think they definitely want to bring in someone with credibility.
That's fair enough. And again, one of the big theses on this show is that, the Fed doesn't actually have that much power. And a lot of it is just, impression and expectation management.
100% agree.
Ansel, do we want to talk about anything else or should we jump into the October report?
Yeah, that's all I had for the Fed news items. I will link in the show notes a bunch of different stuff for people. And if you don't see those where you listen to the show, you can always go to Bitcoin Magazine and find the post for the episode and there'll be all the links there.
Yep. Dylan, you want to share your screen and start hitting on some of these metrics and some of the macro things that are happening both on chain and in the world at large?
All right. So right here, I have it's the long-term holder kind of this supply shock ratio. So basically it takes in long-term holders, short-term holders. And you know, there's only two buckets. The threshold for this is 155 days, but the coin becomes more weighted the longer it's held, because statistically the longer a UTXO is held, the less likely it's going to be spent. And so that 155 day threshold seems quite arbitrary, but there's like a pretty good statistical backtest there. Regardless, it gives some pretty good insight into what the market sentiment is. And when you see this long-term holder ratio reach these kind of heightened levels, what it means is that the long-term holders are controlling a large part of the free float. So we kind of call this a supply squeeze, because essentially that free float of available Bitcoin is very, very small, proportionate to the circulating supply. And so we have these circles of the past times it's happened over the last, 8 years or so. And really kind of, it's almost like a bear market bottom besides that, you know, blip right before COVID, which was, kind of a macroeconomic event outside of Bitcoin. But, you know, basically right before these parabolic bull runs, we see long-term holders take up a huge kind of proportion of the circulating supply. And, you know, we're right there despite being at, you know, flirting with all-time highs. So from an on-chain perspective, the supply dynamics are very bullish.
I have a question on that real quick, if I can. Is that not dollar value, that is just Bitcoin versus circulating Bitcoin, correct?
Yeah, so right now it's this ratio is at 4.45. So there's long-term holders hold 4.45 Bitcoin for every one Bitcoin that short-term holders hold. And so it just kind of, and when a long-term holder, when a coin is moved that was classified as long-term holders, it moves to the short-term holder bucket. So, there is kind of a dynamic there in bull markets where you see as the price runs up, old holders just move a proportion of their coins. And as every time Bitcoin is transferred on chain, is that an economic sell? No. It is not a perfect measure, but in general, when you see these coins that have been held for 5 years, 3 years, just for long periods of time move, it's especially all at once or more frequently as price runs up, there's kind of this dynamic that occurs that the market kind of hits a top. There's just right now there's an imbalance between available supply and new money that's going to come in, and eventually that flip will flip, that script will reverse, and we'll see some sort of parabolic top just based on how Bitcoin trades, or at least that's an assumption. Maybe we don't, and it just grinds up higher forever, but just with the way that Bitcoin has traded in the past, that's what we've seen.
Dylan, is this the highest this ratio has ever been? I'm just eyeballing this chart right now.
I believe so. Off the top of my head, it might've reached a higher peak during the early days when Bitcoin didn't even have a market price. Long-term holder supply is at an all-time high. This ratio, if you look at it right in the corner there, it has peaked just a little bit as long-term holder supply has stagnated and as circulating supply has increased. So the ratio has peaked, but long-term holder supply is right at that all-time high, despite being in somewhat of a bull market. We're seeing like the bear market accumulation dynamic. We highlighted that all summer, saying, hey, like this is the price action you see during a sustained bull market as we're chugging back up to this April high, and we passed it, and we're not seeing any of that profit taking yet, which is a really encouraging sign for bulls.
Would you expect this to get higher over time, as Bitcoin gets used more as a medium of exchange and people store value, that there would be less percent on like retail trading platforms?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting to think about in the sense that there's increasingly like some of the economic volume that occurs on Bitcoin, it eventually will settle on chain as everything does for that finality and like the settlement assurance. But a lot of the stuff happens off chain, right? Where if I have a Lightning channel per se, right? And Lightning's still really small; it's like 3,000 Bitcoin, so almost nothing in the grand scheme of things, but increasingly there will be third-party apps where I can send money on Cash App or something But again, like that's still really, really small. And the vast majority of Bitcoin, economic transfers and sells and is occurring on chain. But yeah, I think, it's interesting to think about, over time, it may, shift more and more off chain, or more Bitcoin may be used as a medium of exchange, and long-term holders as a proportion of the supply, after the monetization event may be a lot less. It's interesting. I haven't really thought about that too deeply, but, you definitely bring up a good point.
Yo, what is going on, plebs? We're going to take a break from our programming to tell you about the resurrection of our print magazine, starting with the El Salvador issue. Starting this fall, Bitcoin Magazine will be available on newsstands nationwide and at retail stores such as Barnes and Noble. Don't want to get off your couch, though? No problem. You can also go to store.bitcoinmagazine.com. So skip the line and get each issue shipped directly to your front door with our annual subscription. I'm talking 4 issues a year that contain exclusive interviews and profiles with leading Bitcoiners, actionable insights on the state of the market, breaking news and cultural trends, along with powerful photos and artwork from the best artists in the world. Subscribe today and get 21% off using code podcast at checkout. That's PODCAST podcast at checkout.
I think this is an interesting one as well. So here we have, so there's what's called coin days destroyed. So you can, so essentially if you hold one Bitcoin for 365 days for a year, you accumulate that coin, that UTXO accumulates 365 coin days. So essentially a coin day destroyed is when after a coin is held for a long period of time, if you move that, then a coin day, or in the sense that if you held it for a year, then 365 coin days are destroyed if you held one Bitcoin. If you held 10 Bitcoin for 365 days, you would destroy 3,650 coin days. And so you see during kind of bull market peaks, this is kind of a similar chart showing, profit taking. Essentially, Bitcoin is held. It runs up 10x, 20x, and long-term holders, stackers in the bear market will, take a little bit off the table, and you see a lot of, coins come to the surface, right? At these blow-off top periods. And so this is the history of Bitcoin, and actually, funny enough, we're nowhere near that point. We're actually the lowest point in this coin days destroyed metric. It's a 90-day rolling sum, so it takes the last 90 days of how many coin days were destroyed and adds them together, and we're at the lowest point in a decade. So what this is telling you is that no one's selling, and it weights it by not only coin volume, just like how many Bitcoin someone has, but how long it's been held. So it's really a pretty telling metric, and it shows just how strong the accumulation has been.
If I could jump in, I feel like this chart and the last chart really do kind of prove Pete Rizzo's thesis a little bit, that the top is this kind of period that forces long-term holders to sell. And it's whatever price a long-term holder, is uncomfortable holding 100% of their stack and not selling. And I feel like these metrics, paint that beautifully. And if you look at October, like if you think that the bull run has started or is done, like we're just at the beginning of the real hype, like the, we're just cocking this bad boy, we're bringing it back.
Yeah. Essentially it's like a spring is just coiling up, and like the mania phase of this, like the reason that Bitcoin trades are flexibly is you see, right? Like, it hodlers, stackers, engineer, supply squeeze. We're going to acquire up as much of this free float as possible. And this is like a kind of a game theoretic standpoint of, I'm going to do this at an individual level, and a bunch of other people and institutions around the world are also going to do this. And eventually any new money that has to come in has to competitively bid up the price. And as that price, bids up by a factor of 2, 10, 20, 100 even, Bitcoin at the end of the day is just money. And so I'm going to move that money, and with on-chain analytics, we can see that movement. And so, yeah, we're in the early phases of, I wouldn't even say, like, despite the price action, it's not even really the bull market yet in terms of what we're seeing from an on-chain perspective. It's still the accumulation phase, which is, quite exciting. And then this one is just, balances on exchange. This isn't really a directional kind of metric like the other two. in the sense that we kind of have a limited data set. And if this chart showed the entire history of balances on exchanges, it basically was in a secular uptrend until March of 2020. And since that point, we've seen the exact opposite. And despite blips here and there with this April and May, with a lot of coins coming on exchanges, it's essentially just been this massive accumulation, not your keys, not your coins, is taking effect. And it looks pretty good to me. And I don't think it's a coincidence that March 2020 was this kind of macro top for balance on exchanges.
I've seen this chart a lot, and I'm not a big fan of this one because the dollar value on chain or on the exchanges is continuing to increase. You know, so it's really, if you look at between March of 2020 and today, it's like 10x more value is on the exchanges. So I see where it is, like in comparison to the long-term holders and these other type of metrics, that this is important to like confirm those other things as well. But overall, I think that, you know, this is a not as informational a chart as the others.
Yeah, of course. I agree to an extent. I mean, it's a lot harder to bid up the price than it was in March or April of 2020. But I think it just kind of shows a trend of just maybe not self-sovereign, because a lot of these, you know, maybe big institutions are using custodians and whatnot. But it's just kind of a way to say, hey, you know, not all this Bitcoin is for sale either. There's a lot of people that are just holding Bitcoin on Coinbase, you know, and think that they are never going to sell. But it's kind of a measure of, you know, what Bitcoin could be sold at the moment. And I think the lower this goes, the better, in my opinion. You'll probably see at some sort of cycle top or, you know, local top, we'll probably see that. I would imagine we see some sort of influx into exchanges, but that's just a hunch.
Well, I was just going to say, like, yeah, I feel like this chart is important. It's definitely not a chart that tells you anything about self-custody of funds, right? But I think it tells you something about intention to sell in like the most rudimentary way. And it probably can definitely show like a flip, right? So when you flip back to coins being added to an exchange, you know, that's probably a bearish sign. But yeah, I mean, I do think it is important. And in combination with these two other charts that show kind of long-term holder sentiment, I mean, it's super bullish. Also, you know, I kind of been pushing this idea of like people are really not bullish enough on the block reward, and that in BTC terms, like we can afford for this stuff to go down in value or down in BTC terms, just because, you know, USD terms or buying power wise, it's just going to go parabolic. So I don't know if you want to like chime in on your thoughts there, but you know, 37 sats is pretty underrated in my opinion.
that was a funny tweet the other week. And I agree to an extent. Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin's designed, engineered to pump forever. So I guess the biggest kind of derivatives futures announcement development in October was the futures ETF approval. And if we're looking at this chart, so this is the CME futures 1 month annualized rolling basis. So what that means in normal talk is Bitcoin has a spot price. If you go on Coinbase or any exchange right now and look at the price. But it also has a futures price. So there's a market for Bitcoin trading next month. And so if you take the spread, the difference between the futures price next month and the price today, and then annualize that difference over a 12-month period, you get the rolling basis. And so basically this basis, you know, during the summer, August and September and into October was kind of flirting with 0 to 5% range. There wasn't much of a premium on the futures curve on the CME exchange. And before the kind of ETF approval or anything formal was announced, just some rumors flirting around, this basis really got bit up in a big, big way. And the ETF was approved on the 19th officially, or started trading on the 19th, but it looked like there was some kind of smart money or maybe in the know traders that had some info. And so they kind of front ran this ETF approval and made some good change along the way.
Dylan, do you see this as like a magnet for the price? And can you explain this like an arbitrage trade here? So if you go short futures and long spot, you talk about that in your deep dive. So,
yeah, of course. So, essentially, you know, Bitcoin has returned, 150% compounded annually for the last 10 years, but, so that's pretty good. But even just 15 or 20% returns, in a way that is essentially risk-free is also very, very good, especially in the legacy world where yields are 0%. Like we talked about in the first part of the podcast, the treasury yields for 30 years is just 2%, in nominal terms. So, with this Bitcoin futures curve, you can go out in a way that's completely market neutral, which doesn't leave you to the, exposed to the downside or upside of Bitcoin. You can collect these pretty big yields. So this is the futures annualized rolling basis on a 3-month period, for all Bitcoin exchanges, just kind of averaged out. And so we saw this annualized rolling basis or contango, as is sometimes called, contango is when the futures is trading to a premium of spot. We saw this hit like 45% earlier in the year. And so, essentially what was happening was there was a lot of speculators that were betting on the Bitcoin price to go up, and they're doing that by buying these futures, contracts. And so that premium rose to a huge, huge level. And in terms of it leading kind of the way, I think it does. And it kind of, it's cyclical with bull and bears. We saw all that kind of leverage and speculation get wiped out in the middle of the summer, where this premium almost basically touched zero. And so, that's the sentiment is very strong with derivatives. And I think there is some sort of reflexivity there, as traders buy the futures, it encourages more people to come into spot, and it kind of, it feeds on itself. But eventually, if there isn't an underlying spot bid, if there isn't someone to come in, and buy the spot and sell the futures, then this kind of huge premium you'll sometimes see, just has to unwind. And so that's what we saw in April. And I think we're pretty healthy right now. This chart has the premium at about 14% on a 3-month basis. And so, I mean, I do think it's an incentive for capital to come into the Bitcoin market. And so in my opinion, it's a net benefit.
When Ansel calls it a magnet, I feel like the layman's way of saying it is that, like, you know, this trade is so enticing at times that it kind of forces anyone who's just looking for yield to, like, effectively, you know, take part in it. And we saw this happen a lot with GBTC and spot, but now, you know, we're seeing it with futures. And some people, like, they think that this is going to be part of Bitcoin's pricing dynamic forever. Like, what's the bigger trend here, and like, why, like how does this play into like Bitcoin's financialization?
Yeah, my kind of thesis on it is that, right now the Bitcoin futures market is very, very small. I mean, it's around $20 billion in open interest for $1 trillion asset. I mean, it's significant, but in the grand scheme of things, it's still extremely tiny. But I kind of view it, maybe not so much the CME, because it's a cash settled, I guess like a paper settled product that you can't use Bitcoin as collateral for. But in terms of like these, I guess, on-chain settled, real UTXO settled Bitcoin futures markets around the world, Binance, FTX, Deribit, et cetera. Essentially, I think you have a cost of capital in Bitcoin terms, for, it's like almost like a native interest rate, and it fluctuates wildly, and it's still very volatile, and there's just a lot of speculation there. This asset is nowhere near mature, but there is a cost of capital for Bitcoin in USD terms. You know, if you want to sell your Bitcoin next March, you can do that, and you can, you know, you can get a 20% annualized yield on that. And so I think as Bitcoin matures from a $1 trillion asset to a $10 trillion asset, or, you know, as it continues to, you know, grow by a factor of two every year or two, I think this kind of physically settled futures market comes up against the $100, $200 trillion fixed income market. And there's no way to centrally plan this. There's no way to centrally plan an on-chain settled Bitcoin futures market. There's no way to centrally plan a Bitcoin spot market. There are concerns from, say, you know, the gold community that, hey, this can get financialized, paper markets can come in, they can suppress the price. But I think ultimately the ability to settle instantaneously with a Bitcoin UTXO on chain, you know, next block every 10 minutes, will keep the market honest. And any kind of disparity between, say, a CME, which is which you can't use real Bitcoin, you can't withdraw real Bitcoin versus say, you know, a real Bitcoin exchange, I think that will show up in the market price. And so I'm not too worried about that. And I think the financialization of Bitcoin in this sense is extremely good and bullish for the long-term outlook.
Yeah, and I also see things like, you know, the perpetual futures, which is kind of, it was invented for Bitcoin, right? So this is something that the Bitcoin market figured out how to do. And the gold bug community or the gold community, the gold market could never have done the same thing because it's not a digital asset like Bitcoin is.
Yeah, 100%. I think perpetual swaps are something that aren't really understood too well. And essentially it's a Bitcoin futures contract that never expires and that rolls over every 8 hours. And so in order to kind of, and you can use up to on some exchanges, 100x leverage on, you know, long or short, and you're marked to market essentially every second. And so right here, you have the funding rate, and the funding rate essentially just is a way to kind of tie the price of this perpetual contract, a perpetual futures contract to some sort of spot index. So right here, I have in this chart, this is the funding rate. And at the top, you see it says 60.2% APR. And so when Bitcoin broke its all-time high, you had a bunch of people, institutions, whoever, traders come in and leverage long Bitcoin via perpetual swaps. And so, you know, when this funding rate hit 0.055%, that's on an 8 hour period. And so annualized, that's a 60% yield. So what you have is there's this huge premium there was this huge incentive to go short, Bitcoin on perpetual swaps. You were getting paid out, 5 basis points of your notional position size every 8 hours. And so if a trader wants to come in and just in a market neutral way, similar to kind of the futures market, you can short perpetual swaps with just this tiny amount of your position and you can get paid a pretty meaningful sum. And so this funding rate is kind of a way to keep the price tethered to spot, but it's also a great way to kind of look at, you know, who's offsides on the Bitcoin price, you know, how much leverage is in the system, betting on the long or short side of things. And when this gets really overheated, like we saw in April, and we saw a little bit, this month, not in the same way, but, just starting to get up there, then I think that's when you kind of got to see that the market's being driven by leverage and derivatives and not so much spot buying.
For sure. And I just see this as such a unique thing that Bitcoin figured out. And the next thing that Bitcoin figures out, it's just going to, stick it to the manipulators that much more. So every time the manipulators will come and try to control Bitcoin's price with futures or whatever the claim is of the gold bugs, something in the market will be created to make it even harder for them to do that.
Yeah, dead on. I think another kind of interesting trend we see is that, so Bitcoin with these futures contracts, and the ability to use leverage, you're betting directionally on the price of Bitcoin, but you're betting on a contract value of this, whether it's perpetual swap or whether it's March 2020 futures or whatever it is. And so you have collateral to enter that position. You need collateral, you need to be collateralized. And so traditionally, like when say Arthur Hayes from BitMEX invented the perpetual swap, all you could use was Bitcoin as collateral. There was no fiat on ramps, and that was traditionally how every Bitcoin crypto derivative exchange works. You could trade all these pairs, you could do all these things, but you needed Bitcoin as your collateral. But Bitcoin as collateral is actually kind of unfavorable for bulls. You're betting on the price of Bitcoin to go up with Bitcoin as your collateral. So if Bitcoin draws down, your position draws down, but also your collateral value draws down and your liquidation price creeps up. So there's like a convexity there that's not favorable. So what we've actually seen since April, when the market was really, really overheated with derivatives, and that was kind of probably the biggest driver of price. We've seen stablecoins, USD collateral, take a larger and larger market share of derivatives. And so that's actually, that's bad news for the bears, in the sense that if the Bitcoin derivatives market is now majority stablecoins. And so if you want to short Bitcoin with stablecoins, as the Bitcoin price runs up, you need more and more stable coins to collateralize. And it's the opposite dynamic of longing with Bitcoin. And so In this sense, there's going to be less, the lower this metric goes, there's going to be less long liquidations like we saw in April and May, and far more short squeezes, which is good news for the bulls.
Less volatility in general.
Yep, dead on. And so I think that's one of the biggest developments. And it's something that's aided by the CME, right? So here's CME futures open interest. It's their market share. And so we saw in January, it was, at this 16-17% level. And now it's, near its all-time highs in terms of overall market interest. And it's actually the leading open interest futures exchange as of yesterday when I checked. And so this is a lot different from the last time we were at 60K when it was, I believe it was Bybit or a Bitcoin native derivative exchange. So just in terms of, and with CME, right, you need to be collateralized, 40, 50%. So the max leverage, if you want to use leverage, is about 2X compared to some of these other exchanges, which you can use 100X. And so, and you can't use Bitcoin as collateral, right? So they're all using treasuries or whatever security they're using to long on CME. There's not that convexity there. The blowups when you have a CME market leading is a lot different than when you have, say, a BitMEX. Those the days of the BART candles with this kind of development are a lot less lot less likely.
I was also thinking the other day about the CME taking over more a higher percentage or a higher share. Is that going to affect weekend volatility? Are we going to see no action really happen on the weekends? It's all going to happen during trading hours of the ETF and stuff.
I think it's interesting. The CME gap was something that we haven't heard about as much, but that was a pretty big meme. And honestly, I was trying back, a year or two ago when there was a lot more noise around it, to figure out if it was just a matter of variance, or it was actually, there were some whales that were trying to fill the gaps. And it's interesting. I think, I'll be following that. And, it's not 100 or what is it, $1 billion of assets under management with these ETFs. And like, I think 5 billion of open interest on the CME is meaningful. And so I think there definitely will be some market impacts there. And I guess we'll see what the weekend price action looks like going forward.
Yo, my fellow Bitcoin lovers, have I got something specifically curated for you? The Deep Dive is Bitcoin Magazine's premium markets intelligence newsletter. This isn't some pay group shelling buy and sell signals. No, this is a premium Bitcoin analysis led by Dylan LeClaire and his team of analysts. They break down in an easily digestible way what is happening on chain, in the derivatives markets, and in the greater macro backdrop context for Bitcoin. This newsletter turns volatility into a joke. So hit up members.bitcoinmagazine.com and use promo code podcast for 30% off the Deep Dive. That's members.bitcoinmagazine.com, promo code podcast for 30% off. Divorce your pay group and learn why Bitcoin is the ultimate asset by Dylan and his team. My fellow plebs, the Bitcoin conference is back. Bitcoin 2022, April 6th through the 9th, is the ultimate pilgrimage for the Bitcoin ecosystem. The Bitcoin Conference is the biggest event in all of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. We're leveling up and making this bigger and better than ever. I'm talking straight to the moon with the 4-day long festival in the heart of Miami at the Miami Beach Convention Center. This has something for everyone. Whether you're a high-powered Bitcoin entrepreneur, a core developer, or a Bitcoin newbie, Bitcoin 2022 is the ultimate place for you to be with your people and celebrate and learn about the Bitcoin culture. So make sure to go to b.tc/conference to lock in your official tickets and use promo code Satoshi for 10% off. Want more off? Pay in Bitcoin and you'll receive $100 off general admission and $1,000 off whale pass. Those are stackable. So go to b.tc/conference and attend the best conference in Bitcoin history.
I was just going to ask, in terms of Bitcoin being more than gold, I feel like, talking about the perpetual swap, talking about the legitimization of this market, talking about stable coins, being actually bullish. I feel like there's something there. And I think a lot of people who are not bullish enough on Bitcoin are people who constantly you know, find reasons to just say, oh, Bitcoin is just gold. Bitcoin is just that. It doesn't solve all of these other kind of value related problems. And I just feel like it's worth kind of pointing out that no, like Bitcoin is a 10x, if not 100,000x improvement as a store of value tool and money from anything we've had in the past. And gold is just, you know, the previous best.
Yeah. It's a global monetary asset that trades 24/7, 365 in an absolutely free market. You know, like the ability, and it's still for say someone in the US, it might be sort of troublesome, but the reality is like I can, you know, send Bitcoin to some exchange, you know, it settles in 10 minutes and I can draw down from that collateral at various, you know, loan to value ratios. Say an FTX, you can lend dollars or borrow dollars against Bitcoin at free market rates. And there's, it's not a fractional reserve system where they tell you what your rate is. It's what the market's willing to pay. All these sort of things, like the financialization of it, are very healthy. And I think that's where a lot of disruption is going to come. Most people don't really understand the second and third order effects of this, you know, free market monetary asset, you know, monetizing in real time.
Dylan, you have some great stuff on the mining sector. Do you want to jump to there? Because we have I have a hard stop coming up here. So, but this mining, I wish I was more highly informed, but there's so much going on in Bitcoin that this is one of those areas that I probably look at the least, but it's one of the most important. So can you fill us in here?
Yeah, of course. So a lot of our mining research in this report was conducted by Sam Rule. Check Sam out. He does great work. We work on the deep dive together. If you don't know who he is, but yeah, I mean, so basically the story of 2021 in the mining industry was the China ban, the massive drawdown in hash rate, all of that, you know, kind of relocation that had to occur almost instantaneously for these operations. We saw hash rate decline by more than 50% in a rapid fashion. We had multiple difficulty adjustments in a row. Essentially, you know, Bitcoin has a mechanism to make it profitable for miners if they turn off their rigs, or to make it increasingly hard to mine as more and more as it becomes more and more profitable. That's the difficulty adjustment. So here's the difficulty, and we've seen, you know, over the last 3 months, we've seen that increase by almost 60%. And just, you know, look at all those positive difficulty adjustments in a row. That's, you know, that means it's getting more competitive for these miners. But I think another kind of metric I really like to look at is the hash price. So this is miner revenue per petahash. Some people like to use per exahash. Some people like to use other denominations. But essentially, this just kind of tells you on a per hash basis how profitable are these miners. And what we kind of see is that compared to say, you know, the same time in 2020. Miners were like 4x more profitable than they were on a per hash basis. So, you know, any ASIC that's essentially plugged in is, you know, churning out money, printing money, maybe printing is the wrong word, but it's extremely profitable for all these rigs. And the reality is most Bitcoin miners don't want to sell at all, or try to sell as little as possible. So the more the hash price goes up, you know, the mining revenue per hash that they're getting in dollar terms, then, you know, the less they have to sell. And so this is kind of another one of those bullish dynamics that we see. And I think that hash price, this metric will actually over the course of 2022 probably continue to increase. There's just a really big supply demand imbalance with ASICs, with plugging them in, with finding rack space. And so, you know, it's going to be super, super lucrative to be a Bitcoin miner for the next year, 18 months. I mean, it is right now. But eventually, you know, that economic incentive to mine Bitcoin, to plug these machines in, to, you know, to create more ASICs, it's very strong, and that difficulty will ratchet up. You know, we'll have another halving, and so eventually, you know, I think this metric is gonna, it's in a secular downtrend. And if I had this entire chart, it would look like basically just flatlined. If you look at it in logarithmic view, it's down and to the right, but. You know, this, we've had kind of this trend shift since 2020, which for anyone that's mining, you know, has been super lucrative.
Yeah. My follow on here is Sam talked a little bit last week, or when the last time he was on, was that last week already?
It was last week, Antel.
Geez. That the miners might be taking some, instead of selling it on the open market, right? They are taking it and creating collateralized products with it. Can you, you know, explain that for the audience and for me?
Yeah. So essentially, you know, kind of linking back to what we were just talking about, it's, you know, the financialization of Bitcoin is a net benefit. Whereas, you know, in the early days you had Bitcoin miners that would plug in and they had to just market sell any Bitcoin that they did mine at any price to cover, you know, their electrical expenses, to cover, you know, OPEX, CAPEX, all of it. But today you have, you know, companies like Marathon, companies like Hut. Marathon actually is partnered with Silvergate, which is a California bank that's a Fed member bank. And they have $100 million Bitcoin collateralized credit line. So they give the banks some of their Bitcoin to custody. The bank gives them a dollar liquidity or a dollar credit line that they can pull from at any time. And, you know, these rates are really low. It's, I don't know if for Marathon, I don't know what their rate is, but, you know, 3, 4, 5% a Bitcoin, an over collateralized Bitcoin loan is there's no credit risk for the bank because they can liquidate at any time or if Bitcoin draws down. So, you know, this is just kind of another development in the financialization of Bitcoin where, you know, there's no credit risk for the banks. The Bitcoin miners don't have to sell and you're paying say 3%, 4%, 5%, even 10% interest, which is really high, especially for, you know, globally liquid collateral, you know, and you don't have to sell an asset that's appreciating at 100% a year or 200% a year. And so, you know, this is just kind of another one of these dynamics where as Bitcoin matures, you know, it becomes more institutionalized. These miners have access to public capital markets. You know, some people may not like it, but, you know, for the price, for the adoption of Bitcoin, it was always going to happen. And it's actually, you know, one of these shifts that's really, really bullish.
Okay, I see. I was confused. I thought it was something other than just, you know, collateralized loans with your Bitcoin. Yeah, and this speaks to what Christian, you were saying earlier about Rizzo and his, you know, will holders sell? Well, holders don't have to sell anymore, right?
That's true. That is a new dynamic. I want to stick on the kind of miner talk again for like 2 minutes and then we can wrap it up because I know Ansel needs to run. But will Bitcoin mining like come to a head with the supply chain issues? Because like, you know, the profitability theoretically on existing hash rate might balloon and there might be not be any way to like service demand to put more hash rate on in an efficient way, given what's kind of happening geopolitically. Have you kind of thought about this dynamic? And like, you know, typically this happens during bull runs, but it's like, you know, lots of people make huge orders at the top and, you know, those orders are fulfilled. But I feel like it's not going to be that easy this time.
Yeah, I think that's kind of, you know, to an extent, that's what's already playing out. We've seen, you know, prices, you know, 5x since 2020 and hash rate just hasn't been able to keep up. The supply chain kind of destruction around the world, the semiconductor shortage is just playing one small part. And Bitcoin miners are definitely not at the top of the list for these semiconductor chips. And you know, the lists on these foundries. And so I think that's, you know, that's what we're going to see play out. There's obviously, as Bitcoin continues to pump, the value of these ASICs, the economic incentive to produce more of them will increase, but I think there's definitely a lag time. And you also have to plug these things in. There's a lot of ASICs just from talking anecdotally with some miners. They're like, hey, yeah, I mean, we got some old machines that we'd love to plug in. We just don't have rack space. And so this is, you know, and this is a kind of, It was coupled with the supply chain disruption and then kicking all these Bitcoin miners out of China. You know, there's all these miners looking for excess energy and it's out there. It just takes a while to get plugged in efficiently. You know, it's still quite small. I mean, Bitcoin mining as an industry, right? I think it produces about $50 or $60 million a day at this point. So it's significant. But you know, compared to what the size used to be, but it's still really, really small. And I think, you know, it eventually will be somewhat commoditized, but, you know, during this bull market, I think this miner revenue per hash blows out in a big, big way. I think you're going to have a lot of miners come in late, purchase a lot of really expensive machines with, you know, somewhat expensive power sources and lever up, and there'll probably be some sort of liquidation event, you know, where these guys all get wiped out. And I think that's just kind of natural. But yeah, I think for the meantime, if you're plugged in, you're very happy. And especially, you know, these miner valuations, I think all these miners were up 13, 14% just today alone. So, you know, they're all levered on their balance sheets. And so I think, you know, in the time being, there's a good chance that they may actually outperform Bitcoin. But you know, maybe not buy miners, just buy some spot.
Well, the price has to drop by what to make them not profitable. So I don't know if that era of Bitcoin is over. Are we going to see a price drop that would get down low enough to say that, you know, $6,000 Bitcoin is not profitable?
Yeah, I think that's where the difficulty kind of adjustment comes in, where you're going to see with all this hash rate that comes online over the next 5 years. I mean, hash rate will increase by probably, I mean, I don't even know. Hash rate will eventually increase by an order of magnitude just with Moore's law, with more miners being produced. And you'll see that difficulty just rack up. And I kind of think of that as like a production cost of Bitcoin just continuing to ratchet up. The production cost of a Satoshi will pump forever. And so I think if the price, you know, got chopped in half tomorrow, a lot of these miners would unplug because it's just not profitable, and you'd see difficulty just kind of downwards adjust. You know, I know for a fact there are some miners with no cost of electricity. So they're just, you know, they're mining at any price, but that's not true for everybody. But I think that's just one of the beauties of Bitcoin. You know, right now it's super lucrative. If price got cut in half, it wouldn't be as lucrative, but you know, difficulty would downwards adjust and increase that incentive. And, you know, it's one of the most beautiful mechanisms in the world, the difficulty adjustment and you know, the Bitcoin network.
Dylan, thank you so much for coming on and sharing these insights with our audience. Where can people learn more about you and remind people what you're working on again?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Dylan LeClaire _, doing the deep dive at Bitcoin Magazine. It's our, you know, financial product where we talk about on-chain analytics, derivative markets, mining, macro. Just joined the UTXO team, so that's super exciting. But yeah, I mean, I really appreciate you guys having me on. This was a fun rip.
Yeah, absolutely. And hey, to the listeners, we're going to have Dylan or Sam on every single month to go over their monthly report and kind of dive into what is happening on chain, what's happening in broader macro, and keep you all informed of what's happening in Bitcoin and in the world, because Bitcoin is just this thing that is, you know, so pivotal in the world these days. And this is the best show to keep you abreast of all of that. So thanks so much for listening. You can follow me at CK_Snarks. You can follow Ansel at Ansel Lindner. Make sure to share the show. Make sure to subscribe to the Deep Dive. Dylan is now offering a free version of the Deep Dive too. So check that out. You can get a lot of this stuff, including the monthly report, eventually on that free edition. So, you know, that's the very least you can do. And it's some of the best information in the space, in my opinion.
Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
All right. Peace.